Good morning, everybody. I'm Larry Goulder. I'm the chair of the Economic and Allocation Advisory Committee. I'd like to welcome you all, committee members, public, and others, ARB staff, Cal EPA staff, to this meeting today. This is our third public meeting of the committee, and I think we have an exciting agenda for today. But to start us off, I want to say that I'm extremely pleased that David Crane, who's special advisor to Governor Schwarzenegger, is here today with a couple of remarks that he'd like to make to start off our meeting. So, David?
Thank you, Larry. I have 4 points that I'd like to make to you all this morning. First is to thank you again for your work on this most critical subject. The second is, as many of you may be aware, AB 32 is under attack already. And it's therefore all the more important that we come up with suggestions for imposing and implementing AB 32 in the most efficient and economically positive fashions. Third is that not only will the legislature and the governor be paying attention to the output you come up with here, but your work will have significant impact on the regions that are looking at implementing similar plans, the country which is looking at implementing a plan, and the world. And as I said before, when you first started, the eyes of the world are truly upon the work of this commission. And lastly, and speaking of economics, we remain very interested in the opportunity to recycle the revenues that are generated by AB 32 in whatever fashion you end up recommending they be generated, recycling those revenues back into California's economy. That's in the context of either the current tax system or any new proposed tax system. We're keenly interested in doing what we can to see those revenues boost economic growth. So with that, thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I look forward to listening.
Thanks very much. We're really glad you're here, and we take our responsibilities very seriously. So thanks for the pep talk. I think we could start off by going around this table and having the members of our committee and members of the Air Resources Board who are around the table identify themselves and indicate affiliation. So, Steve, why don't we start with you? You want to make sure you turn the microphone on.
Okay. I'm Steve Levy with the Center for Continuing Study of the California Economy.
I'm Matt Barger. I'm a senior advisor to Hellman & Friedman.
I'm Dalit Spirchwal with Resources for the Future.
Should be working.
Okay. Jim Bushnell with Iowa State University.
Bob Fisher, Director, Gap Inc.
Larry Goulder, Stanford University.
Justin Adams with Chang & Adams Consulting.
Nancy Sidhu, LA Economic Development Corporation.
Kevin Kennedy. I'm not a member of the committee. I'm with the Air Resources Board.
We weren't really interested in identifying ourselves. We just want to make sure you learned how to use the microphones. Oh, yes. We have two people who are coming in through telephone or through teleconferencing. Can you identify yourselves?
Sure. Vicki Arroyo with the Georgetown Climate Center.
And this is Chris Canito with the University of California, Davis.
All right. Thanks very much. I'd like to make a couple of introductory remarks and give an idea as to what's on the agenda for today. And I hope that the slides that were to accompany these brief remarks are there. Great. So as indicated here, I'm going to give an idea of the timetable as we complete our work, some of the stages of work, what stages we've accomplished and what stages lie ahead of us, and then indicate again how that relates to today's agenda. So next slide. We've been working under a pretty tight schedule. The plan is that we will complete a report representing part of our work this December, that is, and certainly before the first of the year. As I understand it, we are going to have a public teleconference later this month. Has the date of that been determined yet? Not yet. Okay, it'll be sometime late this month. Then we're going to have a public meeting, a face-to-face meeting, in middle of November. It's Wednesday, November 18th. I want to emphasize it's Wednesday the 18th, not Thursday the 19th, as it was originally suggested. And one of our tasks is to have completed a draft of our allocation report. I'll indicate in a moment what that means, allocation report, by the November 18th meeting. So we've got our work cut out for us. And then based on public commentary and other discussions going on at that meeting, we will finalize our report. And sometime during the week of December 13th, we will have our final meeting. And we'll try to firm up or indicate specifically the dates for that final meeting as well as the public teleconference very, very soon, hopefully this week. And there's some other work that goes on having to do with assessments of economic impacts of AB 32. That's part of the work of this committee, and that work will likely continue after January 1st. Next slide, please. So just to provide a broad context, the EAAC, the Economics and Allocation Advisory Committee, as the two first words in that name suggest, we have two main roles. The economics role is to look broadly at the economic impacts of AB 32, not exclusively the cap and trade component, but AB 32 broadly. And that involves a number of things, looking at some of the key inputs to models that have estimated economic inputs, look at the range of models used, their strengths and weaknesses, look at their results, consider some alternative inputs to the existing models as well as alternative models as well. These are models that the ARB has been using, the Air Resources Board, but we may be suggesting some additional modeling work or alternative models. And more generally, we're going to be advising the ARB on the modeling of economic impacts and comment on their existing modeling assessments. And as we'll discuss in more detail later on today, I think that the Economic Impact Subcommittee has done exceptional work already along these lines, has already provided, I think, very useful advice, and will continue to do so over the next few months. The other main role is the allocation role of the EAAC, and there we're focusing on the allocation of emissions allowances in the cap and trade component of AB 32. And our role here is to develop analytical frameworks, identify and evaluate options concerning both the use of different methods, such as various types of free allocation or different types of auctioning, as well as once to the extent that revenue is being brought in, and David Crane's comments at the beginning suggested some potential valuable uses for that revenue, we would be looking at how we might use revenue to the extent that it is brought in under the cap and trade. I might mention here that there really isn't, it's not simply a matter of deciding how much to rely on free allocation versus auctioning, but more specifically to determine what particular form of free allocation to use or what version or what type of auctioning to introduce, because there are several different opportunities there, and we'll talk about that later today. Next slide, please. In keeping with the fact that we have two different roles, we've divided into subcommittees to focus on those roles specifically and even sub-roles. There's the Economic Impact Subcommittee that's led by Jim Bushnell, and it's, as indicated already, is looking at the potential economic impacts of AB 32 as a whole, not just the cap and trade component. And this afternoon we'll be focusing on that subcommittee effort. In addition, the allocation role really has enabled us to divide into subcommittees to focus on that. one subcommittee is called the Allocation Mechanism Subcommittee, which is being led by Dallas Bertraw. And it looks at different options for free allocation and for auctioning of allowances. In addition, it wants to come up with estimates of the total allowance value that would arise under these different allocation mechanisms, because that's obviously going to be important in then thinking about what can be done with the allowance value. It helps to know what the total is to begin with. A second subcommittee, which is being led by Matt Barger, is called the Allowance Value Provision Subcommittee. It doesn't exactly roll off the tongue, but we think it gives you the idea of what it involves. It looks at alternative ways to make use of or distribute the allowance value that comes in from these allocation mechanisms. There are obviously several competing uses, as Matt will indicate as we go on. There's use of allowance value for compensation, use of allowance value perhaps to provide dividends to the general public. There's use of allowance value to finance investments. And as David Crane's initial remarks indicated, you can use allowance value to finance reductions in other taxes and help the economy avoid having to rely on so-called distortionary taxes. So one of the real challenges of this subcommittee is to try to come up with reasonable ways of determining how to spread this allowance value across competing uses. And then as to help us along in many ways, we have a legal subcommittee that's led by Joe Nation, which tries to indicate what are the legal rules that surround our options and perhaps in some cases might restrict us unnecessarily. So we want to understand the legal context, and that subcommittee is very helpful to us. Next slide, please. So today's agenda in the morning, what we're going to do is focus primarily on the allocation rules in general. We'll see progress reports offered by the subcommittee chairs. Joe Nation is not here today, but I might have a word or two to say about the legal issues subcommittee work, which has been very helpful to us throughout. We'll have a break after these progress reports. We'll have general committee discussion, which will occupy most of the morning, and we'll also have significant time for public comment. After breaking for lunch, the afternoon will be devoted to the progress that the report of the ARB and its updated economic analysis, and then there'll be a progress report by Jim Bushnell, who's heading up the Economic Impact Subcommittee, on the work of that committee. That will be followed by full committee discussion and public comment. One thing I wanted to mention, I should have mentioned earlier, is just frankly, I've been very impressed and happy about the nature of the discussions among the members of the EAC committee, how much the members have been putting effort into this, and the very constructive and positive atmosphere that's been generated not only in the public meetings but in the conference calls. So I want to say I think it's been a pleasure. I've been not only have we made a lot of progress, but I think it's been extremely gratifying to see how much effort has been put in such a constructive way. I also want to thank the ARB staff and staff from CalEPA for being very helpful throughout. Next slide, please. So the last few things I want to say is just to indicate where we are in terms of stages of work and how it relates to the allocation as opposed to the economic impacts role. Next slide. Well, the Allocation Methods Subcommittee, which again is headed up by Dallas Bertraw, I think we're sort of phasing from some early stage work to later stage work. And to begin with, in the very earliest stages, a lot of the work was really conceptual, to try to lay out the key ideas, lay out the rationales for alternative methods for allocation, that is, various methods for freely allocating or auctioning allowances, sort of pointing out their potential pros and cons. More and more, we've been moving to an empirical effort, although we continue to sort of work out and clarify the conceptual component. The empirical part really involves getting data and other sort of historical information to try to assess the relative effectiveness of all these alternative methods based on historical experience, et cetera, in terms of, for example, the amount of leakage they might imply, the administrative costs, behavioral responses, et cetera. So here we actually can't just be philosophical. We have to think about some real-world experience and numbers are involved. And we're moving more and more to that component. And ultimately, I think we use the empirical as well as the conceptual information to arrive at recommendations. As you'll see, we are not yet at the recommendation stage, but I think we're going to be moving very, very much into that stage between now and our draft report a little more than a month from now. Then the next slide, please. Similarly, I think we move from the conceptual to the prescriptive in terms of the allowance value provision subcommittee's work. On a conceptual level, and that was what occupied us in the very first stages, we were laying out the general rationales for these competing uses of allowance value, whether it's for compensation, for dividends, for investments in green technologies, or for cutting other taxes. But now we have to get more and more to the empirical side, which to figure out what are these different distributions mean in terms of these criteria that we're concerned with of cost effectiveness, the distribution of impacts across affected parties, and environmental effectiveness. So we actually need to come up with numbers and see, for example, if you distribute allowance value in one way, how much will it undo, for example, the disproportionate impact that might also otherwise fall on low-income households, just to give one example. And then finally, we're going to be moving toward the prescriptive, which is to based on the concepts and on the empirical information, what is it that we'll recommend? And that obviously is going to be increasingly important as we move toward our November draft. Next slide, please. It would help perhaps to mention once again the criteria that we have settled on for selecting among these different options, whether it's in terms of the allowance methods, the allocation methods like free allocation versus auctioning, or whether it has to do with the different ways of distributing allowance value across competing uses. The main criteria we focus on, although we may be bringing in some others as well, are cost effectiveness, trying to keep the cost down. And David Crane's initial comments indicated how important that is, in particular to insulate against certain kinds of attacks which may not be justified against AB 32. We want to keep the cost down. There's the issue of equity or fairness, obviously. There's the issue of environmental effectiveness. We don't want to introduce programs that would lead to a lot of leakage so that, for example, the emissions reductions in California are completely offset by increases in emissions elsewhere. And it's always hard to do this when you've got other competing goals, trying to keep it simple so we can get it's understandable and ultimately can get public buy-in. I'd like to emphasize that I think these criteria are very closely connected to stated objectives in the law. Next slide, please. So what I did is I looked at the AB 32 Act and I kind of, with a little bit of paraphrasing, tried to indicate how they connect with our objectives. So for example, there's language in the law that says that the AB 32 should seek to minimize costs, should minimize administrative burden. That's obviously very compatible with our cost effectiveness goal. There's also language in the law that says that we should design regulations in a way that's equitable, that ensures compliance with the regulations, assures that compliance with the regulation doesn't disproportionately impact low-income communities, that it directs public and private investment toward the most disadvantaged communities in California. To me, that's very much in line with our fairness objective. And then there's also explicit language in the law that says minimize leakage, ensure overall social benefits, including reductions in other air pollutants. This is very compatible with our environmental effectiveness objective. So we believe that our overall criteria are very much in line with the stated objectives in the law. Next slide. So again, this is our final slide. I just want to again say that in the morning, we're going to be concentrating on the allocation role. In the afternoon, on the economic impacts role. One other thing that I had meant to mention is that we've had excellent coordination with a subcommittee that was put together by the ARB about the time of AB 32, the Economic and Technology Advancement Advisory Committee, or ETAC Committee. They've been extremely helpful already and will continue to be, particularly as they indicate what are the potential benefits from using allowance revenue or allowance value and devoting it to finance investments in new technologies. So we're very grateful to the ETAC for their being so accessible to us and having provided us reports and other information. So with that, I'd like to turn the floor. Well, actually, let me stop and see if there are any questions by the committee as to where we're going before we start. Was it clear what we're up against or what we're planning to do today? And if there are no questions, let me turn the floor over to Dallas Bertraw, who's heading up the subcommittee, the allocation methods subcommittee. And he's going to give a perhaps 20-minute presentation as a progress report, and then we'll follow that up with Matt Barger talking about the allowance value provision subcommittee's work. Then we'll have a break and go to general discussion of the whole committee. Dallas.
Thank you, Larry. Good job. Good orientation. Thank you. This is organized as what we see to be two chapters in our ultimate report. So I'm going to go through these two, which are first mechanisms for allocation and then addressing the issue of total allowance value. I just want to thank the members of this subcommittee who are listed here. And as Larry said, we've had a lot of conversations, and they've been very engaged and rigorous conversations, and not heated but exciting, and so it's been very constructive, and I've learned a lot. Okay, next slide, please. So in talking about the mechanisms for distributing allowances, I'm going to touch on three things that are emerging, how our ideas are taking shape. First, a brief general discussion, which is place for a much longer general discussion in the report itself, then talking about alternatives for free allocation and alternatives for auctioning approaches. Next. In general discussion, these are just a couple points that float to the surface because they're not widely appreciated, I think, whereas a lot of things that could be said are more readily understood. There are many justifications for the provision of allowance value, and we have a different committee that's looking at that and is going to talk about that. Free allocation offers various ways to achieve that, and assigning revenue from an auction is another way to achieve that provision of value. So to a large degree, an auction type of approach can be made to look like an allocation approach, and an allocation approach can be made to look like an auction approach, but they inherently have certain administrative advantages for achieving certain kinds of outcomes. And the way that people usually think about auctions or allocations is the way, for the most part, I'm going to categorize them when I present their advantages and disadvantages here. I want to make sure everyone appreciates that free allocation embraces not just lump sum distributions, that is, giving allowances to incumbent emitters or to some entity in the state, but it can also be done in an incentive-based way, that such as output-based or updating allocation, where allocation is reviewed on an ongoing basis and changed. And doing so can provide incentives that can change production activities, and that is a surgical tool that can be advantageous, but it can also have unintended efficiency costs. It's not to be taken lightly. Okay, next slide, please. Here I've just collected onto one slide a taxonomy of the major approaches to free allocation and where we've seen them so far. So I think people, at least nationally, are most familiar with grandfathering under the 1990 Clean Air Act amendments for sulfur dioxide, for SO2. This was given to incumbent emitters, and there was no adjustments to them. But a historic-based approach, that is, looking at some metric that's in the past and not revisiting the question of allocation, that's what's done in the SO2 program. That is also the basis for both many of the state decisions in the NOx-CIPCOL program and in the EU and in Reclaim. But in those cases, there are adjustments that are made. Because the SO2 program, for example, compliance entities today have an allocation set 35 years from today out into the future, which means that there are already plants that have retired that are continuing to receive an allocation of SO2 emission allowances. To an economist, this is beautiful. Because the allocation scheme is not providing any incentives that divert us away from cost-minimizing, cost-effective behavior in compliance with the regulations. So it appears to be efficiency-enhancing. But to the layperson, and to maybe many people in this room, it appears quite odd or potentially absurd that allocations continue to sources that have already retired decades hence. So there are adjustments that are made in these other programs, but one of the problems here is that these adjustments in turn convey all sorts of incentives that cause their own difficulties and take us away from a cost-effective outcome. So that's when we do free allocation on the basis of some historic metric in the past. What kind of adjustments might occur, by the way? Particularly, it's around new sources or sources that retire, whether there's a change in the allocation. The updating approach is, again, free allocation, but in this case where we're revisiting what the allocation basis is over time. So it might be a recent year or last year or the rolling average of years' performance according to some metric. And this can be done to emitters, and that's done in many states, probably most of the states in the NOC-CIPCOL program. It was also done in the lead phase-out, which was not a cap, emissions cap, the lead phase-out of gasoline, but it was really a tradable performance standard with the goal of being phasing out lead to virtually no lead gasoline. And the basis for these kind of updating allocations can be either output or input to production activities, or it can be emission rate benchmarking. So it could be, you know, fuel specific or industry specific, where an agency such as CARB could establish the benchmark emission rate, and that's the basis on which allocation is made to an industry. You can also think of updating to consumers through local electricity and natural gas companies, and here is where we enter sort of a gray area, because I mentioned that you can achieve many of the same outcomes with either free allocation or an auction. This has often come up in the context of using auction revenues to direct them back to consumers or to households or to others. But conceivably, you could directly allocate free allowances also, and then let those entities bring those allowances to the market. The committee is in the process now of developing a matrix of pros and cons associated with each of these, but I'm not going to take the time right now to present that to you and go on now and talk a little bit about an auction and then compare at a higher level the pros and cons of free allocation compared to an auction. So next slide, please. Now, I think many people think auctions are complicated or confusing because there are so many types of auctions out there. But the reason that there are so many types of auctions out there is because there are so many kinds of goods and services out there that get brought to an auction. What we're talking about here is a multi-item, that is, there's multiple allowances that are being sold, and it's a homogeneous good. That is, every allowance is equivalent to every other allowance in terms of its value in the market. So this takes what is seemingly a complicated terrain and brings it down into really a pretty simple framework for the auction choices that that present themselves for us. And they can be organized around two key features. So the first is the number of rounds of bidding in an auction. And there's two types here. You can have a single sealed bid auction. So you leave your envelope at the auction door, and when they open the envelopes, that determines who the winners are going to be. Or you can have a multiple round bidding process in which the bidder has a chance to change their bid after they learn new information. And that typically is done in a variety of ways. But the two well-established and historically famous ways are the English ascending clock or the Dutch descending clock auction. And just so you know what I'm talking about, the English ascending clock auction, essentially there is, you can think somebody says, you know, what do I hear for 50? What do I hear 50? Except it happens electronically these days. And entities submit how much they're willing to buy at that price. If demand is greater than the supply, then the clock ticks up by some value to maybe from 50 to 60, and then bids are resubmitted. And that ascending clock continues until demand is reduced and demand equals the supply that's being brought into the market. So in summary there, the number of rounds of biddings is there can either be a single one-shot bidding process or a multiple round bidding process. And then the second feature is how the price is set in clearing the market. So a uniform single price for all transactions is just that we all pay the same price. Whoever the winners are, whoever's bid the most in order from who bid the most, who bid the second most, who bid the third most, we tally all those up. And until we get to a point where there's just equal to the number of supply that's being put into the market, and it's that last bid that essentially clears the market, determines the price that everyone is going to pay. Or you can have a discriminatory approach in which everybody pays their actual bid. And so we'd all pay differently. We'd actually pay what we bid. Now, in terms of the properties of these different types of auctions, there's quite an analytical literature about advantages of one or another, but most all of the analytical results actually revolve around a single good, not auctions of multiple goods, like multiple emission allowances. So, but there's strong intuition that comes from one that can be borrowed for the other, I think. But most of the work is really done in laboratory experiments in terms of seeing how these auctions actually perform and what are their efficiency properties. And in practice, each type has been used. And this is not the place to go too far in terms of commentary of advantages or disadvantages at this elevation or at this level of detail either. But the uniform price sealed bid auction is what is being used in REGI in the 10 Northeast states. It was used first in Ireland and has been copied by some other countries in the EU. The discriminatory price sealed bid auction, where everybody pays what they bid, is used in the SO2 trading program, where people don't realize, as I said, it was free allocation to historic emitters in the SO2 program, but 2.8% of those allowances are clawed back by the government, run through an auction, and the revenue is returned to their original owners. And this is like a pump priming mechanism. It was put in place when some people didn't have faith that environmental markets would emerge. We've learned a lot about that since then, and they certainly do emerge. But there is an ongoing SO2 auction. It has played an important role in price discovery in that program, and you pay what you actually bid. So, for example, in the first auction, when I bid $290 and the market cleared at around $160, I had to pay $290 to acquire my allowance. So there are some, relatively well-informed and uninformed bidders, I suppose. But there's also strategic incentives that get introduced from this. So there's advantages and disadvantages in that. The uniform price multi-round auction was used in the state of Virginia when it auctioned its NOx allowances. It was an ascending clock auction approach. And then, as an example of a discriminatory price multi-round auction, the FCC Spectrum auction, it runs something like that, although it kind of falls out of some of the categorization I've already made. Okay, so just to review so that, we keep things, not make things any more complicated than they have to be, there's really just these two key features in designing an emission allowance auction, which is the number of rounds of bidding and how price is set. But there's a number of other details that follow. Next slide, please. Here I'm just going to touch on some of the criteria that you can bring to bear to making decisions about the features of the auction. And these are ones drawn from the REGI process, which was a stakeholder process and that REGI embraced in making its auction choice. So there's the goal of worrying about administrative costs and the transactions costs for the bidders, the perceptions of fairness and transparency, and whether the auction type is perceived as being transparent. It conveys a lot about whether it's perceived as being fair. Whether it's economically efficient, that is, whether it gets allowances to those who value them the most, although there is a secondary market, so it doesn't have to. This isn't the only way you achieve efficiency, but it's still a good virtue of auction design. It'd be kind of strange to have an auction that was sending allowances to parties that were not those who were really going to use them, because it suggests that it opens the door for market manipulation. Avoiding collusive behavior by bidders and providing good signals about market prices. I mentioned this was a very important role, the important role of the SO2 auction, because at the time in 1993 and 94, when allowance trading was brand new and there wasn't much trust in this new institution, and there was an array of bilateral trades that had prices all over the map, and then there was this auction. And the auction presented a summary statistic about what the market clearing price was. And people thought, oh, that price is too low. That's not right. It went around for about another year. There was a bunch of prices all over the map. And then there was another auction. And that price, again, came in lower than they'd been trading on average on the bilateral basis. And within a month after that, the bilateral secondary market collapsed to the auction price. And since then, they've walked virtually lockstep ever since. So the auction provides this important role of price discovery, which has advantages compared to bilateral trading, perhaps. Especially for lesser informed parties. Helping to minimize price volatility, raising reasonable revenues, and compatibility with existing electricity and energy markets. Okay, next slide, please. And then these are the decisions that CARB or some entity would have to make in finally deciding on the auction design. What are the vintages that are going to be auctioned? Is there going to be spot and forward auctions? The frequency of the auction, the reserve price, whether there's a price floor below which bids would not be accepted. And so if bids were coming in below that floor, that group of allowances would not go into the market, and that would drive back up the price. How is that set, and what you do with unsold allowances? That's probably been Reggie's most significant contribution, is to write a reserve floor into their auction design. You can do that on eBay. It's generally considered a good feature of auction design, and now it's emulated in both the Waxman Markey and the Carey Boxer Pro formats. Single or multiple auction platforms for WCI, the role of market monitoring, eligibility and financial pre-qualification, and information from the auction that's to be revealed. For example, the SO2 program reveals the identity of the winning bidders and what they bid and the quantity that they win. The NOx allowance auctions reveal market clearing price, or the Virginia auction revealed the market clearing price and the quantities won, whereas Reggie reveals the market clearing price but does not reveal the identities of who won in the auction. So there's arguments to be made around that. Okay, but the next slide summarizes this information for you. It's the last slide on this part of things, which are the pros and cons of free allocation versus an auction. Let me just take you to this quickly. So I did not provide you information about pros and cons of different types of free allocation, because this isn't the place for that, nor of pros and cons in detail of the different types of auction design. But at the higher level, we can categorize some of the pros and cons of one approach toward versus the other. And the advantages of free allocation is that it can provide compensation, I mentioned, to industry and consumers in particular, and it follows from command and control approach where permits are given away for free. And it can be done in a way that provides incentives to reduce leakage and ease the transition for the state economy, and helping preserve jobs and allow for capital investments as the economy transitions to a low-carbon future. The concerns with free allocation are that it's potentially complicated and takes a variety of forms, which will have different outcomes, and that the compensation may not necessarily flow to the affected parties, and there's evidence of windfalls in some previous programs. It invites rent seeking by the parties who are trying to win. They expend resources in order to try to win more favorable allocation, and the outcome may be viewed as highly political as a consequence. Now, an updating or with either updating or with adjustments to allocation, this can provide adverse incentives. For example, these adjustments to allocation can actually tilt the playing field and make it more cost effective, even in the presence of a CO2 program, to invest in coal instead of natural gas. This has been shown in some of the European member states, the EU member states. So the adjustments to allocation introduces its efficiency problems. For an auction, some of the advantages are that revenues can also provide compensation to households, and I mentioned that specifically here, distinct from consumers or industry, because that's the way people have talked about it in the context of dividends. Or it provides revenue to public policy objectives such as investments or tax reform. It can lead to efficient prices and lowest social costs. That's generally, in most comparisons, the auction would win in this regard. It's administratively simple and may have the perception of fairness, and preserves the value of early actions, because parties who have made early actions by reducing their emissions, then they have to bid for fewer allowances in the auction. So it preserves the advantage of the early actions. The concerns about an auction is that it's perceived to raise the cost for industry and consumers. But this is not really true, and it's not true in competitive markets, but the perception certainly goes this way. Updating allocation can lower the cost and prices for industry. That's a special type of free allocation. Allocation to consumers can lower the cost to consumers because it directly compensates them, effectively lowering their costs. But prices are not going to be determined if we're operating in the world of competitive markets. And concern is that efficiency and distribution outcome ultimately depends on the use of the revenue. Okay, a lot for comment on that when we come back to it. Next slide, please. Now let me quickly go through just 5 minutes more, Larry, on total allowance value. And as Larry said, understanding the total allowance value is important to its potential uses, whether there's a lot or a little. And the value is going to be simply the price of allowances times their quantity. The uncertain element here is what is the allowance price. And so I've listed here some bullets, and I'm going to talk through each of these that are issues in forecasting what the allowance price is going to be in the future. And next slide. Okay. channels for reducing emissions. That is, what are the ways that emissions are expected to be removed from the economy? And we can categorize them in three ways. One is output, changes in the level and composition of demand. Another is input, changes in the quantity and types of fuel used, and to some degree process changes. And then there's also abatement for CO2. In this decade, we do not have post-combustion controls, but there is offsets essentially play this role of abatement. And all these channels provide opportunities for short run, that is behavioral kind of changes, intermediate run process changes and minor capital investments, and long run major capital investments or R&D. Where do you look for what is going to be determining the allowance price? Well, one hint is that in the presence of banking and with banking, as is anticipated by us, I think, for a cap and trade program in California, then allowance values and opportunity costs over time are going to be related because of the value of bank relates the value of actions over the years of the program. And also, it's important to note that these allowance prices are going to be directly affected by CARB's complementary policies that may be put in place. Next slide, please. So in the short run, provides a sort of upper bound on the allowance price if technological change is slow to emerge. So we want to, the committee is organizing information about demand elasticities, that is like how industry and households would respond to a change in product prices, what kind of conservation and reduced emissions results directly from that, just in the very much in the short run. What relative fuel prices imply with respect to the short-run cost of CO2 reductions in the electricity sector. And these should provide sort of a notional upper bound in terms of what allowance prices are. Then intermediate and long run, we'd expect to see capital costs playing a role in the electricity sector. Efficiency, land use, other factors are going to determine allowance prices. Next slide. In thinking about all this, though, it's going to be very important to pay attention to the policy variables that are going to affect the price, and they fall into three kinds of general categories. The WCI market design guidance addresses a cap and trade program design, such as the scope, compliance periods, the role for banking, etc., the role for offsets. These are going to have a really important effect within the program. Then CARB's complementary policies that target actions that would not otherwise be identified and emerge under a cap and trade program could have a very important role on allowance price, because if for one reason or another, either an action is cost effective but the market will not pick it, or that there's a variety of issues to do something and but its cost per ton is outside the envelope of items that the market would be likely to pick, then doing those things is going to leave less work for the market to do, and it's going to drive down the price of emission allowances. And things that fall into that category are the RPS, the solar roofs program, vehicle choice policies, some end-use efficiency measures, low carbon fuel standard. All these things are going to be squeezing emissions out of the California economy and leaving and some of that will be redundant of what the cap and trade program would have done, and some of it may not be, and it's particularly important of those things that are not redundant with what cap and trade would have done anyway. And then there's the social infrastructure decisions, which in the long run are really important. Investments in rail, land use, electricity transmission, real-time electricity meters, etc. Other policies by other agencies entirely may be putting things in place that are going to affect the cost of squeezing carbon out of our economy. Next slide. And then there is this question of leakage. The committee is taking this really seriously. Leakage has to do with both the migration of jobs or emissions out of state, or both, because there's no environmental gain to globally have the California reduce its emissions only to see those emissions crop up elsewhere, and there's certainly no gain to see jobs leave the state and to see those jobs pop up somewhere else doing the exact same kinds of processes leading to the exact same kinds of emissions. Allocation approaches can be used to address leakage, but they are going to be likely to increase the price. So leakage itself is going to lower the allowance price. Allocation approaches to address leakage is going to increase the allowance price. In the interest of time, let me just jump on to the next slide. And finally, we're organizing a set of estimates that we've identified have appeared in the literature previously. There's an array listed here, but I want to ask the public also to bring to our attention in comments today or in correspondence other estimates private and public, of what is going to be the allowance price in your view, and what kinds of things are going to most directly shape that. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Dallas. It's clear that your subcommittee has done a huge amount of work, and in my view has organized the ideas very, very well. Also clear that we've got a lot of work ahead in terms of getting the numbers behind a lot of the dimensions that you've articulated, but I think you've made great progress. Congratulations. I'd like to turn the floor now over to Matt Barger, who's going to talk about the work of the Allowance Value Provision Subcommittee. Matt?
Okay, hopefully I'm going to get my slides up here. There we go. Maybe we can go to the first actual slide. So I'm going to speak to what have we actually been doing since we last met publicly. And our group has been getting together by telephone weekly and also exchanging emails. And there's been a fair amount of work that's been done, some of which has actually been posted at this point for the public to see. Sort of within the groupings that Larry outlined, I'd say the first work we have done is conceptual, trying to assemble and group alternatives for the allocation of free allowances or from cash from auction. And we recognize some of these are somewhat artificial and tend to bleed from one category to another, but we found it useful to try and make it a little bit of a simpler categorization for us to think about. And those are the areas of compensation, investment, cap and dividend, and general fund tax relief. And I'll go into what each of those are in a little bit more detail in this presentation. And the second stage we are well into would be the empirical one that Larry touched on. We've assigned responsibility by expertise and interest to the various individual subcommittee members. And we're busily working, sort of analyzing the available information. And again, these are, in many cases, areas of deep expertise, and a lot of work has been done by various members of the committee in the past on some of these alternatives. Go to the next one. And we're now sort of getting into the edge of the empirical and the prescriptive of trying to figure out how do you weigh the absolute and relative merits of each of these potential alternatives. And again, Larry touched on sort of the things we're looking at, but their fairness, social return on investment or environmental return, efficiency gains, and things like timing issues, that some of the alternatives might be more appropriate earlier on in the AB 32 implementation, and some may be more appropriate as time goes on. And then in terms of potential legal issues, I think we've touched on that before. We're trying to be cognizant of them and work with Joe's committee, but also to the extent that we identify things that where there may be legal issues, we may still recommend them and recommend that there actually be changes in laws and the like. So we're trying to be flexible in our approach to potential legal issues. And we're just now sort of getting into the prescriptive of beginning work on trying to achieve some consensus on what our conclusions and recommendations will be, and I expect that'll be really the coming months' real emphasis. And again, as much as possible, we're trying to be guided by the work that has already been done by various committees, including the Market Advisory Committee report and the scoping plan. And finally, we're obviously trying to be very cognizant of the variety of objectives and requirements of AB 32. The next slide. So the first category that we've looked at is, or first alternative is compensation, and within that, compensation to industry. And we've tried to, in each one of these sort of categories, think about what's the rationale, why would you do this, just for starters. And the rationale here would be you'd compensate for the economic impact on California businesses from the implementation of AB 32. And importantly, I think from our point of view, we're trying to not just address the impact of cap and trade, but really the broad parameters of AB 32, you know, the whole implementation of it. What industries are most likely to be affected? High elasticity of demand, the trade exposed would be the classic example of people that are unlikely to be able to pass on to consumers price increases. A high intensity of carbon fuel use, high difficulty of, fuel substitute. It's basically the heavy energy users who have difficulty switching fuels to cleaner fuels. You actually can calculate losses, using some assumptions about elasticity and allowance prices. And we're very interested to hear where Dallas's committee ultimately comes out and what those might be. And we're one of the things we've been struggling with is whether or not the electricity sector is a special case or not. And on the one hand, it's a very important sector that's going to be heavily affected by AB 32 and, merits special attention in that regard. On the other hand, we would expect the costs of AB 32 to end up being passed on to electricity users. And, so this may more appropriately be important to look at sort of the impacts on those users as opposed to the impacts on either the businesses or their shareholders. We spent a fair amount, or individual committee members have been doing work researching, what the relevant literature is. And what we found is most of the work and economic work has been done in a national context and is fairly limited for California alone for economic impacts. And again, we're working with the Economic Impacts Committee to try and get some work that's a little more focused on what the impact is on California. Go to the next slide, please. And here's some of the things we're wrestling with, the challenges to actually targeting compensation to industry that we've faced so far and would just surface. The first is, obviously there's multiple scenarios out there. You can imagine a world where California goes it alone, or you can imagine sort of the other end that you've got regional and national cap and trade environs. And obviously that's going to affect people like trade exposed industries, quite differently. A second sort of issue we're wrestling with is many of these companies are publicly traded. The market's already made an assessment of what AB 32 is going to do to those businesses. The share prices have reflected that. Affected shareholders, may be long gone at this point. Giving compensation to shareholders who bought at a distressed price might be a windfall of some sort, in fact. In addition, sort of conceptually, many shareholders of businesses will be, by definition, out of state, and therefore you'll have money going from in-state to out-of-state parties, diluting the economic benefit to Californians. So, how do you think about that? There's a sort of an ancillary question we don't know the answer to, which is, would compensation like this, in fact, be a taxable event? To the extent it was a taxable event at a federal level, there'd still be further leakage out of California. We've wrestled with the question of whether or not, small businesses are differentially affected relative to large businesses by AB 32. I'd say we're hampered by there's just not a lot of information out there about small businesses and the impact of AB 32. Conceptually, we've thought, one obvious difference may well be the lack of access to capital. And maybe one of the things that we want to address under the investments section, figuring out some way to make sure that people have capital to, for instance, make investments in energy efficiency sorts of things. And then sort of a critical issue is, just sort of overarching is, are we really trying to focus on assisting transition from one state of the world to another, or are we really trying to compensate? And those are two different things. And you sort of think about the parable about giving a person a fish and they have dinner for that evening, teaching them how to fish and, they have dinner forever. We're trying to help people, learn how to fish and sort of move on to what the new world is. The next slide. The next category that we were considering under compensation were low-income households. And all households are going to have higher costs directly from higher costs for electricity, natural gas, gasoline, and then indirectly as businesses in California pass on their higher costs from AB 32 to consumers. This can be expected to have a regressive impact, as has been noted many times. And in thinking about what do you do about that, one of the things we don't want to do is negate this new price signal that we put in by subsidizing energy use for low-income households. If we address this, we'd want to address it in some other way. And sort of an instructive example that's out there of a possible approach to this is the Waxman-Markey has allocated 15% of allowance value to relief for low-income households. Go to the next slide, please. And then the final area that we looked at in compensation was the category would be displaced workers, and this would be people who lose their job as a direct result of AB 32 implementation. And one analogy we thought of was the Federal Trade Adjustment Assistance Program that we could use as a possible model for a way to address this problem. And benefits could include actual cash transition payments, or they could, in fact, be, again, sort of investments in things like training and job search and relocation allowances and the like. And again, we're doing work trying to determine really what is the extent of, you know, potential worker displacement. There's not a lot of information on what that might actually be for California at this point. And the next one. Next slide, please. Thank you. The next category we looked at was the so-called cap and dividend, which is a direct refund of some or all of the auction revenue on an equal per capita basis to all California residents. And there's sort of a number of possible rationales that are linked. The first would be that this is a way to share equally in the creation of in the ownership of a newly created property right. It meets a test of being sort of simple, equitable, and transparent, and, you know, which are sort of good policy tests, and, you know, probably the sorts of things that are simple enough that, you know, people can get behind. It interestingly enough, the work we've done to date would say that it actually has a distributionally progressive impact, that actually you can imagine lower deciles of household incomes would actually come out with a net benefit from a distribution, depending on the actual size of the distribution, relative to their increased costs from the implementation of AB 32. And to the extent that such dividends actually turned out to be taxable, and again, we were unclear on that at this point, it would actually further the progressive effect. Go to the next slide. And so there actually are some precedents for this idea out there. Both sort of an existing one would be the Alaska Permanent Fund that distributes out the oil revenue to state residents. And then in Waxman-Markey, ultimately, they're planning to allocate about half the allowance value on an equal per person basis. So it's, again, another sort of interesting example of that approach. Next slide, please. The next category we looked at, alternative we looked at, was investment. And this is investment of auction revenue to, you know, address the broad range of objectives included in AB 32. And the, you know, first question is, why would you make investments at all? And I think a key rationale for us has been addressing market inefficiencies, things like energy efficiency investments or funding of basic research or job training. And we're very cognizant that the whole point of cap and trade is to put a price on carbon and, you know, stand back and let the market work its magic. And so we're trying consciously to stay out of the way of that. But we're also conscious that the markets are not perfect for a variety of reasons, and that where we can address sort of market imperfections and achieve AB 32 objectives, that's where we're really trying to focus on. And then the other thing we're trying to do is focus on encouraging early action. And you can think of things like, you know, funding an investment tax credit. And obviously, you know, the sooner you attack the problem, the better. And again, you know, early action is a key AB 32 objective. You know, in terms of thinking about how do you compare objectives, you know, Larry's touched on this. Obviously, we're trying to address the key objectives of AB 32, no matter how you categorize them, is sort of the bottom line. You know, things like being equitable and innovative and pioneering technology, cost efficiency, and the like. Next slide, please. The next thing that I think we have a consensus on is that we're quite keen on using existing institutions rather than creating, you know, new institutions from whole cloth to the extent that you choose to do investing. And you can think of, we use the example of California Energy Commission Research, Development, and Demonstration Division as an existing program that you know, expends quite a bit of money each year doing many of the types of investments that, you know, we would probably think would be promising. But you could also think of the PUC or, you know, existing university research institutions and the like. So within investments, one category is support of greenhouse gas reduction solutions. And those might be things such as energy efficiency, renewable energy, smart growth, smart grid, et cetera. And the market inefficiencies you'd be addressing in this particular case would be things like split incentives, you know, where you could think about, say, rental properties where one person pays for energy efficiency investments and another person benefits, or lack of information, or, and again, this is an energy efficiency problem, lack of access to capital and or unreasonably high personal discount rates. Again, you know, we've touched on when you're comparing these sorts of alternatives against each other, you want to reference the array of AB 32 objectives, realizing that not very many of them are sort of objective or quantitative, and many of them are qualitative. And then I think within these, we're focused on really trying to say, you know, what is cost effective, to help compare what are the things to really focus on. You know, relevant existing institutions, you know, we've listed some of the ones that are out there right now that could be good overseers of money allocated to these particular sorts of programs. Go to the next slide, please. This is a personal favorite slide of mine, so it keeps appearing, but this is from a McKinsey study in 2007 that was looking at both sort of existing technology and sort of technology that's in the pipeline in the sort of near to medium range, and looking at the cost per ton of carbon abatement. And interestingly, their work said that there was a bunch, all those things that are underneath the line on the left, that are actually negative costs, which you would think in a you know, market economy would be sort of a strange thing to have exist. And that is sort of the argument of that there are inefficiencies out there and there is sort of low-hanging fruit and there's reason to make investments to go try and get those, most of which are energy efficiency type investments of one type or another. Go to the next slide, please. The next type of investment potentially would be an investment in job training, trying to match the skills and the needs in the new green economy. And, you know, this question, you know, do they pay? Who benefits? You know, the argument is employees benefit from new training, potential exposure to new jobs with higher earnings. Businesses gain from not having to do the training themselves, having workforces available for them. And that states ultimately actually can do better from higher tax revenues on the one hand and lower support payments on the other. And the studies to date, you know, with caveats, would be generally positive on these sorts of programs. Next slide, please. And again, several models exist that, you know, from different perspectives, employers, the workers, or community colleges and private sectors that already do a lot of work in this area in terms of helping train people for green occupations and the like. Next slide, please. And then the final category we thought about in investments was disadvantaged communities. And AB 32 has a strong emphasis on helping communities that are already adversely impacted by air pollution, and also an emphasis on economically disadvantaged communities. And in many cases, those are the same thing. Next slide, please. And the rationale here, again, is sort of a fairness one, that there's communities that are overburdened by cumulative pollution impacts. It would be good, to the extent possible, to address those. And then there's a substantial sort of efficiency and environmental one, which is you get a substantial co-pollutant reduction benefit from reduction of carbon in these communities. And so you get a real payoff in things like reduction of health benefits. Some policy options we thought about were allocating some fraction of allowance value to community benefit funds so they can directly invest in these communities in things like energy efficiency. Introducing a co-pollutant surcharge, again using proceeds to the community benefit foundations. Establishing zonal trading systems so that you guarantee that emission reductions happen in specific areas. That's certainly a complication to the simple auction that Dallas is trying to advocate, but it's something that's actually been successful down in the South Coast. Next slide, please. And then the final alternative we looked at was tax relief and general fund. And this is the notion of sending auction revenue to California general fund, either to offset tax revenue loss to specific tax deductions, reductions, or for just general unspecified governmental use. And some of the tax changes we were thinking might be possible would be using tax changes, actually, to compensate affected industries. Encouraging businesses to take early action, you know, again, this investment tax credit idea. Providing general tax relief for both businesses and consumers, and the notion that they're all bearing a higher cost from the implementation of AB 32 as it filters through. And providing, you know, what's called been called a green tax shift, providing a new revenue stream for the California Treasury. Next slide. And, you know, some of the rationale for this would be intergenerational equity, you know, paying for our budget deficits now rather than passing them on to the next generation. There's a strong economic efficiency argument that, you know, taking taxes that are distortionary, like income and sales, and taking them over to this more sort of green tax actually expands economic efficiency and expands overall income. I think it also might go to some extent towards addressing the issue of California business competitiveness, both real and sort of the image of it. And then finally, and I'd say sort of quaintly, even to some members of my subcommittee, there's sort of a question of, you know, should elected officials actually be making some of these difficult decisions as opposed to others, appointees and the like, between, you know, innovative new technologies or, you know, classroom size and the like. That is it.
Well, thank you very much, Matt. I think, again, I'm struck by the impressiveness of the amount of work that you've done in your subcommittee and how you've so well you've organized the material. Again, we have a lot of work ahead of us, particularly on the empirical side and in the prescriptive side, but I think your subcommittee is well on its way, and I thank you. I think now would be a good time to take a break. I suggest we take a 20-minute break, and then we'll reconvene for a full committee discussion and public comment.
Ladies and gentlemen, if you could take your seats, we'll get this meeting back on order.
Okay, thank you, everyone. A question has come up as to how the EAC committee deals with or responds to comments that come from the public. I'd like to ask Mark Wenzel, who's at Cal EPA, who has been our key contact at Cal EPA throughout and understands the process very well. Mark, if you could say a few words about how it is that comments that come in are relayed to us and how we approach them.
Sure. Thanks, Larry. I'd like to say first that we welcome all comments. Please send them to eaac@calepa.ca.gov. The comments once received are put in a PDF format and posted on the EAC website, usually within a day. They are also distributed to the committee members. They're available on the website. I know the committee has looked at them. For convenience, today we've printed out a volume that has all comments received as of Friday. These are all posted on the website, but this is just a printed version for the convenience of the committee. And then there are two more that were received this week where members brought their own photocopies, stakeholders brought their own photocopies, and we distributed them to the group. So they are making it to committee members. The committee, I know, is Larry can speak to this better than I can, I'm sure, but has appreciated the comments they've received. We'll look at them and incorporate them, and of course welcomes future comments as well as the work proceeds and they get closer to recommendations.
Thanks very much, Mark. Also, I'd like to say another thing about process, which I think will be especially useful to our committee. I think we're all asking the question to ourselves, how is it that we're going to get from here to there? How are we going to come up with a draft report on November 18th? And I wanted to suggest the following approach, but I'm open to changes or to modifications. As you know, we already have a fairly detailed outline of the report, and I'm speaking now of the report that has to do with the allocation role of our committee, not economic impacts. Perhaps as an aside, I'll say that the economic impacts work will probably also lead to a report, but the deadline for that is not so close. That could come after the first of the year. So with regard to the report on the design of the allocation component of cap and trade, we have a very detailed outline already. What I'm hoping is that in the next few days, the chairs of the allocation method subcommittee and the allowance value provision subcommittee can try to consolidate their slides from today and the other information they have, mesh it with the current draft outline, so that it becomes an even more detailed outline, which in a way is a template for the report. I think we're well on our way in that regard, but I think the extent that we can really be sure that all bases are covered and that they're covered in a way that's logical and clear and comprehensive, that would be very useful. Then what I hope is, once we've done that in the next few days, Dallas and Matt can relay to the individual members of their subcommittees responsibilities for writing components that are implied by that detailed outline. And then those the committee individual members will write those pieces, give them back to the subcommittee chairs, and then give them back to me, at which point I'd like to work further with smoothing it out, helping to integrate the various pieces. At that point, we'll have something approximating a draft. I realize this is hard in part because we still lack some of the key information that we need, especially on the empirical side. But I think if we start to do the work and start getting things very much focused in terms of a very detailed outline, that will be helpful in getting the empirical work done because it will make very clear what are the most pressing empirical needs, and it will avoid our going after some information which ultimately we really don't need. I would also mention that in order to keep the report readable, I think that we probably want to relegate a lot of the detail into an appendix, both to keep the report readable and relatively short, but also to avoid including too much technical detail, which might make it less readable for the intelligent layperson who's not a specialist in these areas. So some of what individual committee members write, I would ask that when you write it, you do it with an eye to suggesting, here's what I think should be in the main body of the report, and here's what I think should be put in an appendix. So that would be my initial suggestion as to how we get from here to there. But and I hesitated. I wasn't sure whether to suggest this now or after we've had the full committee discussion. But maybe it's useful to do this now because it could perhaps guide the discussion that follows. So any thoughts, comments, reactions to this proposal? Nancy.
Let me make sure I can work this. So where there's work that still needs to be done or details that we don't have yet because the other committee is working on it or something like that, just put in a bracket and said details to be supplied later and then just go on.
I think so. Yes,
okay,
but I think we should be working
tractable.
In tandem in the sense that we start writing even when we don't have, rather than wait for all the details to come in, we just include placeholders for the information we still lack.
Okay.
Jim Bushnell.
I think we'll get into this afternoon, but I wanted to foreshadow that one of the things we should talk about this afternoon is what is realistic to expect to have those brackets filled in by the time this first report is done and what we may not have in time.
One thing that I might also mention is that perhaps the most important part of our work is the ultimate recommendations, and I think in effect we're going to save that for last. That is, we can be writing what, as you know from the outline, are sections 1 through 5 of the report in a way that doesn't yet require us to make recommendations and save the recommendations for last. I would also add that the first section, which is the introduction, which lays out the role of cap and trade in AB 32, the significance of allowance allocation, the formation of the EAC, the history, EAC's mission, and our criteria for choosing among the alternatives, I'm hoping that ARB staff can create the initial draft of that first chapter. Yes, Bob?
Yeah, I would just suggest as we go through both Dallas's section and Matt's section that we work hard to continue to return to the evaluation, to the criteria. I think you did a great job early on in this meeting of laying out those four key principles that we've worked on and how those relate to the AB 32 objectives. And I think made a very compelling case that we're treating all of those within all the objectives of AB 32 within those four criteria. But I just think it's important as we look at whether it's looking at the different, looking at auction versus allocation, looking at dividends versus compensation versus investment, that we address each of those criteria specifically in sort of in a grid form, as I've spoken about that a little bit earlier, so that we're sure that we address each criteria for each option, because I think if we keep returning to the criteria, we'll all be able to use the same kind of framework in our ultimate evaluation.
Okay, I think that's a good point. And by the way, Vicki and Chris, I know that you're participating through the telephone wires. or through the internet, feel free to chime in at any point. I can't tell when you want to make a point, but feel free to just chime in if there's an issue you want to bring up. Steve?
Yeah. My understanding of the timing is that an economic impact report would be later, if at all, early in 2010. My mind tells me that even though AB 32 is the law, that what we do here will be the beginning of a reexamination of whether this is good for the economy. The ARB staff may have it, but I think we need in this report to remind people of why we're doing it, what the general economic benefits are. I don't want to argue that this is wonderful for the economy, but if we're going to be talking about compensation to industry or compensation to households or compensation to people, there are some benefits that are supposed to be in this program. We've got a stack of letters here that suggest that even though it's the law, every implementation proposal will be an avenue for reexamining whether this is really good for California. And I'm struggling with that we won't do the economic impact report until later, but yet this needs, our work in December needs a restatement of the basic reason for families and households and the state of why we're doing this.
Agreed. And
whether that's science for pollution or economics, it needs that somehow.
In my list of elements in the introduction, I didn't include what you just mentioned, but I think it is very important to include this, perhaps not only in the introduction, but certainly in the introduction. You know, what is the basic motivation here? What is the justification for having AB 32 in the first place? So I think that should be prominent in the very beginning of the report, and perhaps reminders later on. A good point. Other comments about this general strategy of producing the report? Okay, well, I'm going to interpret that as meaning that you're generally on board with this. If you have new thoughts as you fly home or drive home, that, oh, this is crazy or there's some real problem here, let us know because there's time to adjust. But otherwise, we'll continue along these lines. So now we have time for general discussion. It's somewhat artificial always to divide up the issues the way we have. I mean, everything interconnects. How you use allowance value, which is what Matt's subcommittee is focused on, is going to depend a lot on what Dallas's committee ends up suggesting, subcommittee ends up suggesting as to the total amount. So they're all interwoven. That said, I think maybe it would be most useful if we try to segment our discussion on some of the main topics as best we can, and to keep it focused. So what I suggest is that we start by talking about the issues related to the allocation methods subcommittee, Dallas's subcommittee. And if one of you makes a point and another one of you has an idea that's closely related, could you signal that maybe by putting up your placard, maybe if we'll use the placards to say you want to make a point. But if you hear some other point being made, and you want to make a point that's closely related, rather than turning to a new point, if you'll just raise your hand to signal, we'll do it that way, and then I think we'll keep the conversation as focused as we can. So the floor is open, Matt.
So I have a question, Dallas, which is, you just touched on Larry, but we don't have your work yet on what allowance values are likely to be over time. And I think one thing we were just touching on during the break was volatility, which I hadn't even thought about. You know, just sort of what are the year-to-year impacts going to be on prices, which will flow through to, you know, what's the allowance value. And in thinking about some sorts of programs, as an example, you don't necessarily want to allocate money to green tech that's sort of bouncing around year to year and not available in any, you know, predictable way, which I hadn't even thought about until today. So I'm curious sort of what your preliminary thinking are about volatility? And also, to the extent, have you bounded it at all in terms of sort of your thinking about what values are likely to be, or at least, you know, as you get out towards 2020?
First of all, Matt, I'm not going to say anything about what the value actually might be in the context of this meeting. I can only be wrong. And let us put some information together, and then
We recently received some initial estimates from ARB, which are going to be very helpful.
Yeah, it's going to be really helpful. But understanding that this is important information, but I'm not going to try to comment on that today.
Okay.
But this other point is a really interesting one about volatility, and it gets at sort of program design. One feature that I described in auction design, as long as an auction plays an important role in the program, even if it's not entirely an auction, then a reserve price in the auction provides essentially a price floor, which provides quite a bit, not total certainty of a minimum amount of value that's going to come, because, you know, if for some reason the value of allowances were to really go south, then you might really be pulling a lot of allowances out of the market, so the queue could actually start to get smaller. The quantity of allowances that were being issued could start to get smaller. I guess that has to be a good thing from an environmental standpoint. But that a reserve price in an auction provides a minimum price on allowances, and assuming that all the allowances have us, you know, that were most of the allowances or all the allowances are going to be used that CARB decides to issue, then it provides a floor for what the amount of revenue from the program could be. So that's one of the design features that we have available to us. You don't think California needs another source of volatile revenue? that's a real concern. And industry has before argued a concern that prices could spike, and the Market Advisory Committee, Larry will remember, had lots of conversations about the role of a safety valve on the high side, which provides sort of a ceiling for what allowance prices might attain, and decided in that context against recommending the use of a safety valve. But there are other features in the design of the program that sort of provide related function, and that is the introduction of offsets. As long as offsets aren't hitting a cap bounded by the amount that they could come in, and they might be, but to the degree that that cap is not hit, then when allowance prices go up, it brings more offsets into the program, and that will tend to dampen the rise in allowance prices. So that's just a little bit of a feedback on this point, and I think this is I'm going to write this down as something that we want to talk about in further conversations. But when it comes, you know, so to volley it back to you, Matt, it occurs to me that as a member of your subcommittee, that if decisions were made to recommend that allowance value go to investments, that's a challenge with that is a potential volatility in revenue. But if there was any kind of splitting of the cake here, multiple assignments of allowance value, you might think of maybe some should be a residual claimant and some should be the primary claimant on that value, so that fluctuations in value get channeled into certain kinds of expenditures. And if it's useful for investments to have reliable funding into the future, or for communities or whatever, I don't mean to prejudge how that goes, but it seems like there's an attribute there that can be thought about.
Okay.
Making a recommendation.
Steve, it looks like you have a related comment.
No, it's a Dallas comment. It's not related.
Okay. But it's